This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This Saturday, the Orlando Public Library celebrates books and authors at the Orlando Book Festival. The festival has something to entice both readers and writers with signings and writing workshops. Joining us for more is the library's events and programs planner, Sarah Fisk. She writes young adult fiction under the name Sarah Nicholas. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Also joined by Loreen Leedy. She is an author and illustrator. Loreen, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with you, Sarah. Tell me about the concept for the festival.
Part of it is I was hired specifically to do author events, so it was just something that I wanted to do. And also the other part of it was the UCF Book Festival at the time was kind of getting smaller and smaller and then eventually ended. And so we wanted to fill that space too.
And is it just focusing on Orlando authors, or do you try and bring in some authors from further afield as well?
Yeah, we try to bring authors from anywhere. The keynotes are usually people from out of state because we fly them in and everything. Mm-hmm. But most of the other authors tend to be Florida authors because they're the ones that can travel for a one-day work book festival. But sometimes we get some from like Georgia. Mm-hmm. Or even people who have family in Orlando or surrounding Orlando.
So as the festival has matured over the last 5 years, has it gotten bigger? Like, is it becoming something where you're like, okay, we might have to add another day to this thing?
We've talked about adding a day to it. It's just the day would be Sunday and we're open 1 to 6 on Sunday. So it makes it like logistically more complicated. But it also depends on the authors. Like last year we had David Baldacci, who's just like a huge name. And so we had to do some like special things to compensate for the audience that he was going to bring in. And so it depends on who the authors are that are coming in.
Mm-hmm. So Loreen, you are one of the authors for this year's book festival. Tell me a little bit about your work and what you're going to be bringing to this festival.
I think I'm the only picture book author this time. An illustrator. So I'll be focusing on the younger ages. Most of my books, I have over 40 published picture books, are kind of for the upper range of the picture book. So like first and second grade, maybe even older. But my most recent one, I geared towards preschool and kindergarten. So, but they're all fully illustrated. And most of my books are informational. So there's a topic like symmetry or fractions or whatever.
Mm-hmm. How did you get into book illustrating?
Well, I was an art major in college without any plan of what to do with that. And then I had a teacher friend who would bring authors and illustrators into her English classroom to help them, you know, get a sense of what it's like to be an author. And she introduced me to an author illustrator in Philadelphia. I lived in Delaware at the time. And I got to see his studio and all the pieces in the bookmaking process, sketches and character drawings and book plans and the manuscripts. And I thought, oh, I can see how to do this now because I can see all the pieces in this puzzle. Because usually you only see the finished product and it just looks like it hatched out of an egg or something. You don't know how the person made it. So that was helpful to me to see the process. And so I try to share that with audiences, or if I happen to be visiting a school or going to a teacher's conference, give them a little sense of the creative process too.
So Sarah, Loreen is one of the authors you have speaking at the event this year. Tell me a little bit about some of the other presenters at the festival.
Our keynotes this year, we have Daniel Jose Older, who's one of my favorite authors in the entire world, so I was super happy that he agreed to come this year. He writes urban fantasy for adult and young adult audiences, and he also has a historical fantasy that is set during the Civil War, but with dinosaurs for a middle grade audience. So how can you not love that, right? And then Delilah S. Dawson is an author. She writes in several different genres as well. Probably what most people would know her for, she wrote the Phasma book for Star Wars. And she, we've been going to the same conferences for years, so we've kind of known each other for years. So I was excited that I was able to bring her in for this as well. Mm-hmm. And then we have, we actually have quite a few nonfiction authors this year. James C. Clark is an author that we work with around the year. and he wanted to do a panel on writing local history. So we got a couple of local history authors in to mm-hmm. do that.
There's a lot of fascinating history that has tentacles in Orlando and oh, elsewhere yeah. in Central Florida, right? I mean, you learn something new every day about the history of this place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have James come in to do lectures on Florida history all the time. And just like the stories that he tells, you could just sit and listen to him tell these stories all day because they're so random and weird.
mm-hmm. Lorene, we were talking before we got on air about how you came to Florida, and I'm just wondering, from the point of view of a writer and an illustrator, what's it like coming to Florida as far as finding inspiration in the Sunshine State? Is this a good place to be to get ideas for stories and for pictures and illustrations?
Oh, definitely. I've used Florida animals and flora and fauna, I should say, in a lot of my books. My husband and I did one called Amazing Plant Powers, and we ran around the area taking photographs. For example, a palmetto that had been burned in a, you know, one of the typical fires we get in the summers, or a controlled burn maybe, and then how it was sprouting right back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an example of one of the plant powers. And so there's just any number of things you can be inspired by: the nature, the you know, activities in the area, the water sports, the wildlife. So it's mm-hmm. a great place.
Sarah, what about you? I mean, you know, Florida sometimes becomes a bit of the laughing stock of the rest of the country. There are plenty of weird Florida stories. I'm wondering, though, I mean, that when you talk to authors and folks who've lived here for a long time, they're like, that is not the complete picture of Florida. What's your kind of relationship to the state as far as means of inspiration or how you see people depicting Florida? And what's some of your thoughts on that?
I haven't set any stories in Florida yet. I'm looking for the perfect one. But I'm friends with Craig Pittman. Are you familiar with him?
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of his beats is kind of weird Florida stories, and he has a book that's all about weird Florida things. And I love following him on Twitter because you see some of that. But there are definitely some, like, misconceptions when we go out of state for conferences. Like, people will mention the weird Florida man stories, and I always tell it's because all the other states send us their weird people. That's mm-hmm. why all this happens. So mm-hmm. that usually ends the conversation pretty quickly.
Plus, it's a big state, right? I mean, the population is growing pretty rapidly. So mm-hmm. proportionally, there's a pretty high chance you're going to run into some strange stories along the way. And we should back up a bit and say that you write young adult fiction.
I do.
Tell us a little bit about what you've been writing and some of the stuff you've got in the works.
Yeah, so I have two books that are published right now. One was Dragons Are People 2, which was an urban fantasy about a dragon shapeshifter. And then Keeping Her Secret, which was a summer camp girl-girl romance. And the one I'm working on right now is about a girl who does battle bots in high school.
Mm-hmm.
She competes in robotics competitions. And I mean, there's a lot of other things around it, her family and relationships and stuff too.
And that is, you know, talking about battle bots and engineering, that's one of your fields of expertise too, right? I mean, you weren't always going to be a writer. You were
yeah.
thinking of engineering at one point.
Yeah, my degree is actually in mechanical engineering. I have a bachelor's in mechanical engineering from University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in the field for a little while before deciding it wasn't right for me.
Did you take part in BattleBot competitions yourself?
I did not. We did some, so there's what most people do in high school is called task robotics. So we did some of that in college. Neither of my high schools had task robotic teams.
Mm-hmm.
I went to both small high schools. I'm in a military family, so we moved in the middle of my high school. But yeah, I did some task robotics in college, but I never had the opportunity to do battle bots, combat robotics.
Mm-hmm.
Though I've watched plenty of it.
So is this story a little bit of what if? Is there some kind of wish fulfillment going on here?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about how you sort of came to write that first book and why you decided to ditch engineering and move into, you know, the field of writing and library science too.
I wrote Dragons while I was still working as an engineer. I had been working kind of on the side as a book publicist, as a freelance book publicist, and I was planning book events and author events just for fun, kind of. And I was not happy in the job that I was in, and all my friends knew that I was not happy in the job that I was in. And one of my friends was looking for a job, and he saw this job at the library, and he said, "This is your job." And I was said, "You are correct." and luckily I got it. And it was a bit of a change in environment and also salary, but I'm way happier doing it now than I was ever being an engineer.
What about getting that first book published?
Oh, that was, it took a while. So people all the time will say, "Oh, I got like 3 rejections, so I think I'm just going to self-publish, or I think I'm just going to quit writing." And then I tell them, before I got my first book published, I probably amassed 450 rejections because I had queried another book before this that never got picked up. And so, but I had learned so much about the industry in those couple of years, and I'd learned so much about writing too. Most people don't know how to write a book when they start. And so you learn a lot writing those first book, that first book or those first couple of books. And so it makes those first couple of books unpublishable, but it's also worth it because you learn so much while doing it.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Sarah Fisk and Laureen Leedy about the Orlando Book Festival. Laureen, what about the process of getting that first book published for you? Did you sort of go into it thinking there is so much I don't know how to do, or did you have a sort of a pretty comprehensive plan mapped out for how to get it done?
This was 1984, and the internet was not a thing, at least not for me. And so I read a book or two and talked to this author illustrator and this teacher friend of mine about writing. And I just started drawing characters and page after page, you know, painting after painting. And I just made a big pile of source material out of my head without any real plan. And then I eventually showed it to some people and got some feedback. And the other thing I did was I went to the library and looked at picture books, because that's what I had in mind, was combining words with artwork. And I would just take notes on, I'd page through a book and take notes on it, like what worked for me, what didn't, what I thought was a great idea, what I thought was sort of boring. And I just studied it as a model or template, not that I wanted to, of course, copy anybody, but just to get the overall sense of how books are put together and how I might do it. And so after I had this pile of stuff and I showed it to this author illustrator, he showed my work to his editor, and she called me up and asked me if I had stories to go with some particular dragon characters. I had these little blue dragon characters, and I just thought back to my days in sixth grade and eighth grade specifically, where we did some creative writing. And I thought, well, I could do it then, so I could probably still do it now. And I said, sure, I'll see what I can come up with. And then I just sat at a typewriter and typed away and came up with some story ideas, and then went up to New York and met with this editor. And she liked one of them, the story that it was an accounting story that went with the dragons called A Number of Dragons. And she said right then and there they wanted to publish it. And I thought, I was afraid that it wasn't complete enough. It was only a manuscript and a couple of sketches. So I said, well, let me go home and make a dummy of this book, because I knew what a book dummy was by that time. And that's just a mock-up of the book that they can see how it works from beginning to end.
So it has like rough sketches in it?
Yeah, it's sort of like a storyboard for a movie, but it's in page-by-page format. And so I went home, I put it together in a week because I did not want to waste a lot of time. And I mailed it up there, and she called me up and said, well, we'd like to give you a contract for this book. And I was like, okay. So it was, I did not have any rejections. And I've always told people that I would never have been in this field, because at that point, at the type of personality I had, I would have just thought, oh, well, I'm no good at this, so I'm going to give up. I just was not the persistent type, and just by nature. So I had a different story than most people.
After that, though, were there some manuscripts that didn't get picked up, some stuff that you're like, this is still a good idea, but it just isn't getting picked up by publishers?
In one case, a book idea was rejected by my original publisher, and I immediately took it to another one, and they published it. So that felt pretty good. But yeah, there have been times where an idea just can't find a home.
So kind of looking back on your career, Laureen, have there been moments where you're like, I could be doing something else right now? Are you pretty happy with the path you've chosen?
Oh, once I got into publishing, I thought I'd won the lottery. I mean, as far as I was concerned, this was perfect for me. Mm-hmm. Combines writing and art and creativity and elementary level math, which I can handle. Mm-hmm. I ended up doing quite a few picture books with a math topic, mm-hmm. you know, theme, symmetry, or one on measuring, and just over a dozen of them. And that was surprising, too, because I was not a math person.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Sarah? How are people consuming your novels? Do you have any sense of whether people are reading them on tablets or just on their phone or something? Or is the physical book still the main method of getting your work out there?
Yeah, I'm lucky. I with my publisher now, I get quarterly statements, so I know exactly what people are buying. And with Dragons Are People Too, it tends to be more paperback, but with Keeping Our Secret, it tends to be more ebook. And that's probably because of the LGBT content. People mm-hmm. tend to read ebooks in that category.
Why is that?
Because no one can see what you're reading. It's still kind of, you know, a touchy subject for a lot of people. So,
just in the YA field or just in general?
In general. Hmm. But in young adult, generally, the common thing is that ebooks are not as popular as people think they would be, because teens are on devices all the time, but when they're on devices, they're not reading. Hmm. And so for YA, paperback is still the preferred format for most people.
And is that what you're hearing from young readers too? That they kind of tell you, I just love to dive into an actual book?
Yeah, and I don't know if it's that they prefer it so much as when they're on their phones or their tablets, there's so many other things, so mm-hmm. many other distractions. But audiobooks are also like a rapidly emerging market too, or rapidly expanding market. Audiobooks, we're seeing the biggest growth in the industry in audiobooks. So. Mm-hmm.
Have your books been converted to audiobook yet?
No, not yet.
Yeah. Are you a voracious reader?
I am, but most of mine are audiobooks. Because
really?
I work full time, and then I also write, and then I also write for a book news website. So, mm-hmm. If I, you know, have any time, it's usually spent working. So I spend a lot of time listening to audiobooks.
And is that in the car? Like, do you have a long commute?
In the car, cleaning the house, cooking, yeah, all those mm-hmm. different things.
Does it just kind of feel like more work though, listening to audiobooks, since you're so immersed in this anyway as your career?
Sometimes. If I'm listening to an audiobook with a specific purpose, like if I'm listening to an audiobook because I need to write an article about books in that category, then yes. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, I just enjoy it. It's just like entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you a question about social media then, because, you know, it seems like if you're an author, you're trying to get your work out there, that's a pretty important component of what you need to do. How important is it for you for making that connection with readers and maybe adding stuff after your book's out there and people are trying to connect with you and find out more about the characters or something?
And Laureen and I actually met because she came to a workshop that I did on promoting yourself as an author. And we probably spent 2 hours talking about social media that day.
Hmm. Oh, it was fabulous. I took page after page after page of notes.
So social media is important for you as well, Laureen?
Well, I'm trying to make it more of a factor. I've mostly concentrated on creating printable activities to go with my books mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then posting them. Particularly, there's a really huge site called Teachers Pay Teachers, and I put them up there for free. So if somebody wants an activity going with one of my books, they can find it. And I also put it on my website, but it leads to that central location. And that way, it keeps track of how many downloads there are. And my I have one called Jack and the Hungry Giant Eat Right with My Plate. And that's about the USDA, you know, food guidelines. Mm-hmm. And that one's been downloaded over 30,000 times.
What's on a Hungry Giant's plate?
Well, it's basically taking the Jack and the Beanstalk story and changing the ending so that instead of the giant trying to eat Jack, he's wants to cook him a meal.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a turnaround.
Yes, it is. And it's just a way of introducing the idea of the different sections of the plate mm-hmm. within the context of a sort of a fractured fairy tale or a twist on a traditional fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's normal foods. It's just they're big and Jack is small. So it's kind of fun visually.
So, Laureen Leedy, what would your advice be to somebody who's thinking about getting into the field of book illustration or writing books for a younger audience?
These days, there are wonderful resources available, lots and lots of books. You can attend workshops. There's a really great organization called the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators that has a very active Florida group. And you can meet and work with actual art directors that come down from New York and editors and agents. And that was not – if that was available when I was starting, I wasn't aware of it, although I did join the group. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
It's really, really nice to be able to interact with your peers at different levels. You know, some of them are just starting. Some of them are, experienced and have been in the business for a long time. So it's a great way to get started. And, of course, you just have to read a lot and start writing and keep writing. Or if you're an illustrator, start sketching and, keep making characters. And illustrating a book is different than just doing standalone illustrations. You have to be able to carry that continuity all the way through. And so not every illustrator really wants to do sequential art like that. So
mm-hmm.
that is something you have to find out. Is that it would do you enjoy doing a sequential kind of artwork?
Mm-hmm. What would you tell folks who want to become young adult authors, Sarah, or basically any kind of writing who wants to get into this business?
The first part is to read as widely as you can in your genre. A lot of people come to me saying that they want to write a young adult book, but they haven't read any that have been published in the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to read in your genre. You have to know the expectations of your readership. And the other part is to educate yourself in other ways. There are conferences, like Laureen mentioned, the SCBWI conference. There are all kinds of conferences for different genres. The library actually has a couple writing workshops every month. Laureen's taught one on writing picture books. And we have ones coming up on like editing your novel and the basics of self-publishing and how to write steampunks, all different topics all the time. And those are free. And that's why I promote those, because the conferences often are expensive. And so if you can't afford that, it's another option. And there are so many resources available online as well. Authors all the time are posting writing advice and publishing advice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do people need to know about the book festival if they're planning on coming along?
Yeah. So it starts at 10 a.m. with our opening keynote. And then we have 3 hours of panels. And then we have a closing keynote. And then we have the author signing, where you can get your book, you can buy books by the authors that are there and get them signed. You can come at any time. You don't have to be there for the whole thing, but I do recommend you come the whole time. And it's a lot of fun. And there are also going to be literary organizations there. So you can talk to some organizations that do a lot of work. Actually, SCBWI is going to be there. And like Adult Literacy League, all kinds of literacy-related organizations are going to be there. And they're going to be there from 10 to 2, so you can just kind of talk to them whenever you have a free moment.
Sarah Fisk is the Events and Programs Planner with Orange County Public Libraries. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Laureen Leedy, author and illustrator. Laureen, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, we ask Florida's Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez about funding for the environment and education, whether the Sunshine State could still get the Space Command, and why the Florida Cabinet wants to hold a meeting in Israel.
If you look at Florida, no other state hosts more combatant commands. Florida is also home to over 20 military installations. And we also have a long history of support for our nation's efforts in space. I mean, we are space. The Cape Canaveral area, I think if you look of where it has been and where it is today, we have seen the type of commercial investment from our space commercial partners, the likes of which is probably unparalleled.
Intersection's back in a minute.
Lost inside the garden of Eden, eating my pride, sleep deprived. Every evening I'm sleeping beneath the stars. Beat the odds, let them seek out the scars. Secrets and all, follow hard till they feed on my carcass. We could be gods, singing songs for the elegy. I can still hear the melodies. People wrapped up in cellophane, will not cause the ebony. Spinal columns are shivering lately. You're like a centipede crawling across the desert. A mile lower now than ever. All the trees in neon, I see where I dream. I'm free and I'm beyond the reach of reason. To be, I just not to be. I feel empty when you're not with me. I've seen all the scenery.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez says she's thrilled with the outcome of the 2019 legislative session, with more money for Everglades restoration, an increase in per-student funding, and a new education voucher program. Nunez says the legislature secured historic funding levels. I began by asking her whether she thinks there's enough oversight for charter schools.
Well, I believe, and Governor DeSantis believes, in the highest level of accountability, no matter what kind of school you are, right? So if you're a traditional public school or a charter public school, I believe that the governor agrees that there has to be accountability. And so there may be opportunities down the road for perhaps those bad actors in the charter school world to reevaluate that. And so that's something that I think we'll continue to look at. But what I'll tell you is that this was probably a great year for traditional public schools because, as I mentioned previously, it's the highest ever per pupil spending, coming in at a little over $7,600 per student. That's the largest increase. We saw an increase in over $242 from last year alone. And so that's, again, the largest increase in probably 6 or 7 years. And we also with regards to the curriculum, the governor obviously addressed Common Core, which is a huge issue, something that you hear from parents, students, and teachers alike, and really upset about the way that the curriculum had been going in the state of Florida. And so the governor took sweeping action there. And he also addressed an inequity in a program that exists. It's called the Best and Brightest Teacher and Principal Program. And so what he was able to do is eliminate the requirements of the teacher's own SAT or ACT score as a basis for being able to be eligible for that program.
Right.
So this is going to provide more funding to more teachers to really address with the issue of teacher pay. And so there's a whole slew of educational initiatives that we were able to achieve that are great for students throughout the state of Florida. And so what I would say to any detractors is to really take a look at all the strides that we made in education. And I think at the end of the day, when you really evaluate it all and look at it independently of your political biases or leanings, I think you'll all agree that it was a great year for education.
Right. I mean, I guess the year hasn't actually rolled out yet, but as far as some of those legislative kind of scene setters at the start of it, some wins there for folks on that side of the ledger. I want to ask too about environmental funding. That was a big part of the governor's campaign leading up to the election. I'm wondering, though, do you not have to kind of wait and see what the results will be from the spending that has been set aside and just kind of see if that actually, in fact, makes the kind of difference that Floridians are wanting from, say, cleaning up the waterways, reducing toxic algae, things like that?
Well, I believe that the effects are immediate, and I think that that is evident, not just, as you mentioned, in the type of funding and whether it will have the intended outcomes, but also in terms of the governor's his vision of the types of people that he wants involved with his administration. Everything from the secretary on down, he made some changes at the South Florida Water Management District because he wanted to appoint people that shared his vision and were aligned with his thought process in terms of the environment. He also appointed a chief science officer. And so while, yes, many of these things and many of these initiatives will take time, we also believe that there are immediate effects that we're going to be able to see. The amount of funding for Everglades, the highest ever, over $400 million for Everglades restoration, that has already spurred a change of course, if you will, from the federal government. You just saw recently the president indicate that he now agrees with Governor DeSantis, and he has updated, if you will, his budget number from what was, we believed, insufficient to what is now close to $200 million that the federal government, they look to be spending on Everglades restoration and things of that sort. So we believe that it is a comprehensive and long-term strategy, but also also there are short-term things that we hope will really benefit individuals from all walks of life, because as you know, as well as anyone, you know, the effects of last summer with blue-green algae, red tide, it was devastating not only for our environment, but also for our economy and for the health and well-being of the individuals around those communities.
Right. I want to ask about Space Command, because that is something that a lot of folks were hoping would end up in Florida. You yourself, Lieutenant Governor, were campaigning pretty hard to say that this is a good state to situate that. That was not to be, though. Were you surprised by that decision, that Florida was out of the running there?
Well, here's what I'll say. We were a little surprised, but we also are not ready to wave the white flag. Somebody asked me, you know, that the president had made that declaration. I said, no, it was not the president that made that declaration. It was the Air Force. And while, you know, obviously it's not necessarily good news for Florida, I wouldn't say that it's the death bell either, because I think that if you really look at the situation, and I know many members of the congressional delegation, including Senator Rubio and Scott, along with other members of Congress, are rather upset and feel like there is opportunity to readdress what we believe is an inequity. Because if you look at Florida, no other state hosts more combatant commands. Florida is also home to over 20 military installations. And we also have a long history of support for our nation's efforts in space. I mean, we are space. You know, the Cape Canaveral area, I think if you look of where it has been and where it is today, we have seen the type of commercial investment from our space commercial partners, the likes of which is probably unparalleled. And I think there's so many opportunities, and Florida is uniquely positioned to host the Combatant Command headquarters, that while the news certainly wasn't welcome, I would tell you that I am the type of person that doesn't always take no for an answer, and I think we're going to continue to beat down the doors at to anyone who will listen.
So who are you talking to then? Do you think you've got a hearing, or do you have the ear of the president? Can he be persuaded, and can then the Air Force be persuaded to change its mind?
Well, I will. I can't speak to whether the Air Force will change its mind or not, but as Chair of Space Florida, I know we, the Executive Director and I, share the same thought process, that we don't necessarily, we're not willing to concede defeat. We're going to ask our federal partners, who really have they're in the better position to advocate for Florida, to take the lead on this, because we believe that they really have a lot of direct discussions that could be had with folks in decision-making places. And so I think that we're going to lean heavily on both Senators Rubio and Scott and our congressional delegation to make this push and to really insist that they reconsider the shortlist, if you will.
I want to ask about a couple other things, if I may, Lieutenant Governor. One issue that is generating some headlines is the idea of holding a cabinet meeting in Israel. I know that Governor DeSantis has been a very pro-Israel campaigner on the campaign trail, and he seems to be delivering, you know, making good on that promise. But I'm wondering, what are the benefits for the people of Florida in having that cabinet meeting in Israel? And are there some legitimate concerns for transparency as far as what we can find out what happens in the meeting, and, you know, how that information is going to be relayed back to the people of Florida?
I can't speak directly to what will or will not be part of the cabinet meeting in Israel. I know that they're looking at a number of options. Obviously, they will all be vetted through legal and making sure everything is above board and that there is no concerns with access to for the public. You know, this governor is very committed to being open and transparent. And obviously, he has campaigned on being the most pro-Israel governor in the state of Florida. And I think that that probably goes without saying. And his first trip abroad is going to be to Israel. And so I think there are a number of exciting initiatives that will take place and a lot of events that the governor will be partaking in. And so we'll certainly continue to talk about the cabinet meeting. And as that gets fleshed out, I'm sure we'll have more details. But I can assure you that they are looking at it from the perspective of making sure that everything is legal and above board and in terms of access and opportunity for Floridians to know what's going on.
What about cost, too? Because I can see the argument to be made for the governor or maybe one other you know, cabinet member to make a trip there, a trade mission, but is there really the need to fly all of the cabinet out there? And can you tell me what the estimated cost of that's going to be to the people of Florida?
I don't know offhand what the estimated cost will be, but I'm certainly happy to get back to you on that. I wouldn't be able to comment because I'm not sure what the costs are and what the itinerary will specifically look like. I think as details become solidified, then we'll have a better handle on what that is, but I'm happy to get back to you on that.
Sure. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about is the idea of having your headquarters, Lieutenant Governor, in Miami. Clearly some benefits to being closer to the folks in South Florida there. What do you think is going to come out of that?
Well, I'll tell you what will come out of that. It's more opportunity for Floridians to hear from their executive branch. So as you may know, the Supreme Court justices had a similar provision in law last year. And so this year we decided to do it not just for the Supreme Court justices, but also for the Lieutenant Governor, for myself. And that's something that I think both Governor DeSantis and I are very committed to being visible, to being as accessible as possible to the entire state. I don't think I have to tell you how challenging it is to get to Tallahassee from wherever you are. And I think the opportunity to work out of the regional office of the governor, which I want to be very clear, there is no additional cost to opening up an office. We're going to simply work out of that regional headquarters that exists currently today for the governor's office. And so it really just gives an opportunity to bring government closer to the people, for people to sit and to meet with me or to meet with the governor when he's in town and really work in a way that's collaborative and that's going to be, I'm going to be very, very busy traveling throughout the state. And so sometimes it's just easier to be able to travel out of Miami or travel out of one of the major cities as opposed to Tallahassee. But that's not going to diminish my time in Tallahassee and the other responsibilities I have, including Department of Health and Space Florida and Statewide Council on Human Trafficking.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Still to come on Intersection, from avant-garde hip-hop to a concert celebrating Orlando's heyday as an electronic music destination, there's much to look forward to in the gig calendar this summer. We chat to Orlando Weekly music critic Bao Lei Hu. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. There's a packed schedule of music for Central Florida audiences this summer. From cutting-edge hip-hop to West Coast heavy metal, Americana to local experimental bands, Orlando Weekly music critic Bao Lei Hu has his finger on the pulse of the concert scene. Bao Lei Hu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
So there's a lot on this summer musically. There always seems to be when we get you in here to chat about upcoming concerts. Beginning with this Friday, Obliterati, is their final show.
Yeah, this summer there's. I'm happy to report that there's a lot of really, really good local stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This one is going to be a good show. Unfortunately, it's bittersweet because it's another final show for them. A little bit of history for Obliterati. They were a 90s band from Orlando's very freaky side. They're kind of underground legends in that sense, and anyway, they reformed after 15 years dormancy in 2014, and ever since they've been playing fairly regularly, and it's been reinvigorating and also educational to have them back, to have an old school band that I didn't catch back in the day do the circuit again.
Okay, so moving on then, the Fringe Festival, of course, kicked off this week. The Swamp Sisters' La La comes around again. This is something that happens every Fringe Festival, I believe, or
yeah.
At least it has for some time now. So Beth McKee is quite a big influence on Orlando's music scene. How big of an influence would you say she is?
Well, I think she's a very, very big influence, especially considering that really Beth McKee is much more than just a musician. She's sort of the den mother for a very large portion of the female artists in Central Florida and really beyond with her with all of her affiliations with Southern Women. And the La La is just something that she does every year with, and that group is called the Swamp Sisters. And the La La every year at the Fringe is basically the big annual event. part of what they do, and a very interesting and noble part of what they do, is raise funds. What they've been doing for a while now, and it's that way this year, is raising funds for Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida to feed kids over the summer. So they have a whole season of fundraisers, and so this is kind of the crown jewel event of all of those things.
All right, what about the Gemini Party? This is a tribute to a DJ who passed away recently, DJ D-Extreme. Tell me about this DJ and what this kind of party showcases.
Sure. Another quick Orlando music history lesson. In the 90s, and speaking of electronic music when it was underground and when it was good, in the 90s, it was, you know, before EDM was EDM, there was a house music boom that was just global. And what a lot of people don't realize is Orlando was very much at the heart of it. We were on par with New York, London, any of those scenes. In fact, some of the biggest international DJ names of the day, they practically lived in Orlando for parts of the year.
So where did people come to hear this?
Clubs like The Edge, Firestone, the original Firestone. There was Renaissance, the Abyss, all sorts of clubs. And these were, you know, when the day of the all-night parties. So anyway, that was probably one of the most significant chapters in Orlando music history. And DJ D-Extreme was definitely on the vanguard of that, although he wasn't one of the biggest names like DJ Icy or that. But he was really, I thought, one of the most influential ones in terms of the underground. He was one of the resident DJs at The Abyss, which honestly was one of my favorite clubs back in the day. He held down the residency there with DJ Stylus. And anyway, anybody who was deep into the scene of the time were very familiar with D-Extreme and what he's done over at The Abyss in heralding what would be considered Orlando's signature sound, Orlando Breaks.
Earth and Helms Ali are performing at Wills Pub on June 10th. These are kind of heavy rock outfits. What can you tell us about these bands?
Yeah, both of these bands are really exceptional heavy bands. Honestly, either one of them coming into town would be worth the ticket price alone, but having them both is just, and it makes for an incredible bill. Helms Ali is a newer school band that's exceptional in their own right, but kind of pushing the bounds of heavy music a little bit. Both bands are from Seattle. Earth is, in those circles, incredibly famous. Like I said, they're legends with their kind of drone and doom. Honestly, if you've never seen Earth, it's almost like a time-bending experience because I don't know if there's any other band that distills the idea of the riff down as much as they do. I mean, they take it slow and just get heavy, heavy, heavy. I saw them back in 2015. I think it was Orlando had their only Florida date, and it was just a time-warping experience.
Leo Suarez and some others are playing at the Nook on June 15th. It's not a very big venue, to my understanding, right?
No.
Pretty small spot. He's a solo percussion artist, fairly experimental. There probably aren't many working in that genre in Orlando, right?
No, actually, Leo Suarez, I believe, is from the Tampa area, as is Elizabeth A. Baker, who's playing. Jim Ivey is the local. Those three, for this particular show, are performing all solo, but then they're also going to do a trio. They're all experimental artists with all very, very different styles and even different instruments, so it's going to be very interesting. They've all kind of collaborated with each other in various projects, and they all kind of run in the similar circles. It's kind of a cabal of Central Florida experimental artists. Elizabeth A. Baker, she's played in Jim Ivey's Tangle Bell Ensemble, and Baker and Suarez have been longtime collaborators. Suarez, like you said, he's on drums. Elizabeth A. Baker, who was actually a champion of the toy piano, is this time going to be on electronics and objects, whatever that means. I know she incorporates many, many unusual objects into her shows.
Wait a minute. Toy piano. Explain that for me.
They're tiny pianos.
So what you might buy from Toys R Us before Toys R Us went out of business?
Well, yes and no. I've seen her do some of those things, but the toy pianos that she plays are actually real, legit instruments. Mm-hmm. They're just very small, and they have a completely distinct tonal range to them, and she's been kind of experimenting in great depth with them for a while now. Mm-hmm. And Jim Ivey's going to be on saxophone.
What about Sadistic then? This is a rapper who's doing some interesting things in that field.
Very interesting.
What can you tell us about him?
Well, he is a Seattle guy, and he's on the very, very boundary-pushing hip-hop label Fake Four, who recently released Orlando rapper E-Turn's national album and also has Fort Lauderdale's Blue Bird, an incredibly talented rapper, on their label. But anyway, this is probably the most adventurous hip-hop label out there right now. And true to that template, Sadistic is definitely not your typical rapper. First off, when I saw him last night, who knows what he looks like now, but when I last saw him, he looked more like the frontman to a metal band rather than, you know, any sort of a rapper. And then when he actually starts, it's this is definitely not your typical chest thumping rap. This is pretty deep emotional range for rap. It's really more lyrical exploration along the lines of a songwriter, which is not to imply that it's soft, because his rapping is very very tight, and it's a very rousing experience to see him live.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ballet Who, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Always an honor. That's all our energy's nuclear. You look into my nucleus. Tell me I'm too lugubrious. Beautiful fuse elusive. We planted our darkest secrets. The blooming into petunias. Pent a pendulum pulsing just like a metronome. Poison morning, my morning's impulsive. Smelling a petrichor. Sepulchre head and pets are off dead. The weather is never enough. We're never fast and second efforts. Get me left in the mud. Just up above us. There's a galaxy grounds crumpled below me. Thousand people surround us. Inside of me's only lonely. The fireflies used to visit. To sit on my skin. I miss it when Mr. We dissipated, you drifted into the distance.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. Your support keeps local programs like Intersection on the air, bringing you insights into stories that matter to Central Floridians. Whether it's book festivals celebrating Florida authors, a conversation with the Lieutenant Governor about the Space Command and the Florida Cabinet meeting in Israel, or a closer look at musicians making waves in this community. Help support this program and others on 90.7 News by making a contribution during our Spring Silent Drive. We can only end the drive when we make that goal. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go online to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.